Good morning. The passage that Jim read from the Old Testament is from Job. In the last few weeks, we've had a look at Jacob, Jeremiah, Job, most of the J's. They've offered, I think, these last few weeks a kind of an interesting opportunity to look at some of these central figures in the story of the Old Testament. From the dysfunctionality of the all-too-human clan of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to the suffering but faithful prophet Jeremiah, to today, Job, the ultimate pawn in the struggle to understand the workings of God and the affairs of humankind. I don't know about you, but I've always found Job to be a difficult book to wrap my head around in some ways. I don't take it as a literal story of one man's plight so much as a depiction of our common struggle to understand why life takes the turns that it does. It's a book full of arguments that try to explain Job's difficulties or that try to convince him that he somehow deserves what's happening to him. And in case you're not overly familiar with the story, let me summarize it by simply saying that Job's a good man. He's generous to those in need. He's faithful in his religious observance. He's worked hard, and he's amassed a comfortable measure of wealth, and he has several sons and daughters. And by all indications, they appear to be a loving and a close family. Job gives us a bit of a hint, a bit of a glimpse into his own character in chapter 31 of the book. There are 42 chapters in all. But in chapter 31, he describes his relationship to his servants, for example, just as a bit of a piece of who he is. And he says, "If I've rejected the cause of my male or female servants when they brought a complaint against me, what then shall I do when God rises up? When he makes inquiry, what shall I answer him? Did not he who made me in the womb make them? And did not one fashion us both in the womb?" And I like this hint of his sense of egalitarianism. Yes, he has servants, because, well, you can't do everything single-handedly. But he acknowledges that they, like him, were fashioned in the womb by God, and that they, by implication, like him, are created in God's image. And so I sense that I have responsibilities to these people, to treat them with the respect that I expect. But then comes the day when God is holding court, and Satan goads God into taking away everything that Job has: his herds, his wealth, his children, and finally his health. The argument Satan makes is that, of course, Job is faithful to God. Of course, he's faithful to you because things are going well. He's enjoying the blessings of life. Take those things away, and he'll abandon his trust in God and show his true colors. And this particular piece of the story is why I take it as story rather than as history. I cannot conceive of God being manipulated in this way by Satan or anyone else, being prodded, goaded, provoked into acting in the way that we're told God acts later on. I do not believe that we are pawns in some kind of cosmic battle of egos. We may be involved in spiritual warfare, but it's not of a kind intended to prove a point between two supernatural beings. I believe it's of a kind intended to make our experience of life the kind of existence God has always intended it to be, an experience of an eternal quality of life, an experience of life that reflects the divine image in each of us. But in the story, in Job, God acquiesces to this goading, and Job is reduced to a lonely man, deprived of everything except his life. And a number of friends, acquaintances, colleagues, comrades, companions come to him to comfort him. But as time goes on, they really only succeed in aggravating him, because all they assume is that these things have happened to Job because he or his children have sinned in some way. And they each have, each of these companions has their own take on how and why God is acting the way God is acting. But for all of them, the bottom line is, this is God's punishment on Job and on Job's children. And in chapter 8 of Job, we have a bit of an example of that attitude. Bildad the Shuhite says, "How long will you say these things, and the words of your mouth be a great wind? Does God prefer justice, or does the Almighty pervert the right? If your children sinned against him, he delivered them into the power of their transgressions." In other words, they got what they deserved. Now Job refuses that explanation, and he insists that this is not the case. He argues instead that God is acting unjustly towards him and that he deserves none of this and his children did not deserve what they got. So over the course of the 42 chapters in the book, there's a back and forth between Job and his friends as they argue over who's right, who's got the right understanding of what's happening and why is it happening the way it is. And in those exchanges, there are multiple times, I think, that we hear echoes of Jeremiah's cries of distress when we were looking at Jeremiah a couple of weeks ago. And those echoes are there in Job's statements, I think. In chapter 3 already, near the beginning of the book, he says, "Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said, a man-child is conceived. Let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, or light shine on it, and let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds settle upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Yes, let that night be barren. Let no joyful cry be heard in it." That's a very powerful expression of despair, of a wish that I had never even been born. Chapter 9, he says, it's all one, and therefore I say he destroys both the blameless and the wicked. When disaster brings sudden death, he mocks at the calamity of the innocent, he being God. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the eyes of his judges. If it's not he, who then is it? He's a broken man, Job, at this point. And these, I think, are very human expressions of a sense of abandonment and despair, a crying out for solace or respite in the face of flagrant injustice. And I'm convinced that at least some of these declarations, and forgive me if I make reference here to Robert Burns, but I'm convinced that some of these declarations provide much of the inspiration for Burns' poem, "A Man Was Made to Mourn." It's a kind of a bleak take on the plight of humanity, this poem. But Burns does not blame God for this plight that we find ourselves in. He blames, the phrase that we've adopted from Burns is, he blames man's inhumanity to man for the things that we, for much of the things that we suffer from. But some of Job's outbursts, on the other hand, such as the passage that I just read from chapter 9, are in fact accusations against God and God's fairness, or lack of fairness. Job is basically saying, if it's not God who's responsible for the injustice that we see around us, then who is responsible? If it's not God who's blessing the wicked and oppressing the innocent, then what's going on? And he lays out that argument again and that accusation in chapter 10. He says, "I loathe my life, and I will give free utterance to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul, and I will say to God, do not condemn me. Let me know why you contend against me, and does it seem good to you to oppress, to despise the work of your hands, and favor the schemes of the wicked?" It's harsh, and I think it's fair to say it, fairly presumptuous take on how God is at work in Job's life. There's almost a sarcastic tone to the question. But then again, we're told at the beginning of the story that God has allowed Satan virtually free rein in how Job is to be treated. And although Job isn't party to that knowledge, I suppose his attitude is understandable. Why are you doing this to me? You're responsible. Why? I don't deserve this. But in the middle of all of this turmoil in the book of Job, in chapter 19, Job makes the declaration that Jim read earlier. I know that my Redeemer lives. The temptation here, and I suspect the reason that this theme was taken for the lectionary readings for today, is to somehow draw a link between this declaration of Job's and our trust in redemption through the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. A temptation to suggest that this is somehow a prophetic utterance on Job's part. I don't think that's being faithful to the text, and I'm not going to go there. I know that my Redeemer lives. In that sense, is another sermon for another day. I don't think Job is making a kind of prophetic utterance. I think the implication of his declaration is in saying, I know that my Redeemer lives. I think what he's saying is that Job expects God to vindicate him at some point and to prove that he has been wronged. That God will come to his rescue, yes, as a Redeemer, but in such a way that God will admit that God has been unfair, that this has all been a terrible miscarriage of justice, and that Job should never have been treated in this way in the first place. Much later in the book, Job expresses his longing for the good old days when the sun was shining and the birds were singing and God was a friend. Oh, that I were as in the months of old, as in the days when God watched over me, when his lamp shone over my head. And by his light I walked through darkness, when I was in my prime, when the friendship of God was upon my tent, when the Almighty was still with me, when my children were around me, when my steps were washed with milk, and the rock poured out for me streams of oil. Sunshine, birds, butterflies. Job clearly feels abandoned and betrayed by God, and he longs for a restoration of that earlier relationship. And God does re-enter the story in chapters 38 to 41, but not to vindicate Job in the way that Job wants or expects. God chides all of them, Job and his companions, for their arrogance in thinking that they have a corner on wisdom and for thinking that they understand how and why God acts the way God acts. In chapter 38, he says, we read that the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind, and he says, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. I will question you, and you shall declare to me, where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding, who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Who laid its cornerstone when morning stars sang together and all the heavenly beings shouted for joy? My reading of those chapters is that God is saying to Job and his friends that they're too quick to judge each other for misfortune that occurs, and too easily convinced that they understand God and God's ways. They're too quick to assign blame for misfortune, or to see a sign of God's blessing in material comfort. I've never particularly liked the saying that, quote, God works in mysterious ways. I think it's a bit trite, as sayings go. But I do believe that in trying to make sense of why things happen the way they do, we do well to remember that we never have access to the full picture of what's going on. And we certainly don't get a peek into the final chapter of the story of our own lives. I think God is telling Job and his companions that they need to trust that things are playing out as they ought, as painful as they may be, and that the rain will fall on the just and on the unjust for reasons that we simply do not understand. And I'm comfortable with that. I can handle stories that have ambiguous endings. But Mary Lou will readily tell you that she likes stories that have a happy ending or that have some kind of redeeming quality to them. And the story of Job fits Mary Lou's comfort zone quite well in that regard. We're told in chapter 42 that the Lord restored the fortunes of Job when he had prayed for his friends. And the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Then there came to him all his brothers and sisters and all who had known him before, and they ate bread with him in his house, and they showed him sympathy and comforted him for all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him. And each of them gave him a piece of money and a gold ring. And the Lord blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning. And he had 14,000 sheep now, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 donkeys. He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. And here's a curious bit that's inserted here in the next couple of verses. He has 7 sons and 3 daughters. He named the first Jemima, the second Keziah, and the third Keren-Hapuch. In all the land there were no women so beautiful as Job's daughters, and their father gave them an inheritance along with their brothers. That, to me, is a bit of an odd little insertion to highlight this fact, but it's again a reflection of Job and his character that even his daughters are getting a piece of the inheritance. After this, Job lived for 140 years and saw his children and his children's children 4 generations. And Job died old and full of days. I've always said that that's the way I want to go out. I want to go to bed one night in at a ripe old age and perfect health and wake up dead. I don't know if that's how I will go out. I don't know how my next days and weeks and months and years will play out. I think in the book of Job, we're being called to trust that things will play out as they ought, as painful as they may be from time to time, and as joyful as we might hope they might be also from time to time. Thank you.